Lecture 13. Ishvara Krishna and Patanjali, Yoga.
Hello, welcome back. Several lectures ago, we talked about the Bhagavad Gita and three ways to escape the cycle of samsara, reincarnation. There was Jnana Yoga, the way of knowledge, where you realize that Brahman and Atman are the same thing. Bhakti Yoga, the way of devotion, in which you devote your actions and all of the karmic consequences to a god like Krishna. And then most importantly, Karma Yoga, the way of works, and that means to act without thought of the consequences. Okay, all of those three yogas, and perhaps you thought at the time, none of those sounds like what happens at the local yoga center in my town. In this lecture, we're going to talk about the classical Indian school of yoga. There's a connection with a modern Western practice, but the ancient version had somewhat different goals and methods. We'll be focusing on two major thinkers in this lecture, Ishvara Krishna and Patanjali. Once again, we don't know a whole lot about their lives. Even in their dates are somewhat in doubt. But their ideas are tremendously influential. Okay, and once again, metaphysics is going to lead to ethics. In this case, Ishvara Krishna provides the metaphysical theory, and then Patanjali explains the practice of yoga, which is his answer, the practical answer that will resolve the problems that are highlighted by Ishvara Krishna. But we can start with some background. We're going to talk about the six orthodox schools of Hinduism, and at last, we're going to get to the real Darshanas. Remember that we're in the Darshana Hotel in India, and the Darshanas are these six schools. And they developed during the time between India's two early empires, between the Mauryan Empire that was in the 3rd century BC and then the Gupta Empire in the 4th to the 5th century AD. So they're in between. These six schools are orthodox Darshanas because they accept the authority of the Vedas and also the Brahmin priests who specialize in the Vedas and the Vedic rituals. All six schools accept the ideas of samsara, karma, dharma, and moksha, but they have different ideas about how exactly ultimate reality and the self are related and what we can know about them. So these philosophers, these schools, argue with each other, but they also respect each other and they adopt insights from other schools. As I did with the 100 schools of philosophy in early China, I'll give you a quick overview. Now, don't try to memorize this, but just get a sense of the whole, the kinds of issues that these schools address. The six schools are usually grouped into three pairs. So the first pair is going to start with the Nyaya school. And this school concentrates on logic. They say that there are four sources of knowledge: perception, inference, like where there's smoke, there's fire, analogy, and reliable testimony. Okay, I know it's a list, but that is a great list. Think again. How do you know what you know? They say there's four ways. You can directly perceive something, you can figure it out by inference, you can try to compare it to something else, or you can get some sort of reliable testimony from somebody else who is a direct observer of that. Great list. Okay, the next school that it's paired with is the Vaisheshika school. This is a school of atomism. It says that the world, the universe, is made up of very small, invisible, but so small you can't cut them anymore, bits of reality they're going to call atoms. And they list the qualities and the substances that make up the universe. There are material atoms, but there are also some immaterial entities like space and time and mind. This school, the Vaisheshika school, merged with the Nyaya school in the 10th century. Both can be classified as pluralistic realism. Okay, that is, there are many entities, not just one, not monism, not Brahman. There's many entities, and they actually exist independent of our perceptions. Okay, those two schools, important in history, perhaps not so important today. The next pair of schools are Samkhya and Yoga. Samkhya teaches a dualism between spirit and matter. Okay, it's not mind-body dualism. It's something a little bit different. We'll talk about this in a minute. And then the Yoga school is going to offer a practical method for disentangling spirit and matter. And these are the two schools that we'll be discussing in this lecture. That leaves two more. The Mimamsa school, which is an interpretation of the Vedas, which they believed were uncreated and eternal. And this school is concerned with trying to perform the Vedic rituals exactly correctly. So they want to say things with the right pronunciation and do things as precisely as possible. And then the last school that Mamamsa is oftentimes paired with is Vedanta, which means the end of the Vedas. This is based on the Upanishads, which, remember, were texts that were added to the end of the Vedas. And this is a school that talks about the relationship of Brahman and Atman. And it comes in three flavors. There's non-dualism, right, monism, where they're the same thing. There's qualified non-dualism, and then there's dualism. Okay. This is the most popular school, probably the most influential. We're going to give a whole lecture to this later on in lecture 20. So if we were to add three non-orthodox traditions to those six schools, and the non-orthodox traditions are Jainism, Buddhism, and Charvaka, remember the one that was sort of atheistic, no afterlife, no gods, if you can't see it, it doesn't exist. Six orthodox schools, three non-orthodox schools, that's classical Indian philosophy in a nutshell. Okay, now we can move to Ishvara Krishna. He lived in the latter half of the 4th century AD. He was the foremost proponent of the Samkhya school of philosophy, though he's a relative latecomer. Samkhya is one of the oldest of the Hindu schools, but it didn't reach its classical form until Ishvara Krishna, whose verses on the Samkhya is the first complete text of that school that survived. It was actually translated into Chinese in the 6th century, which is a rare non-Buddhist transmission of Indian ideas. At least one time when something got from the Darshana Hotel to the Tao Hotel, but not through Buddhists. According to Ishvara Krishna, all of the entities that make up the universe can actually be reduced to just two. Remember, it's a form of dualism. There's Prakriti, which is primordial matter, on the one hand, and Purusha, which is pure consciousness or spirit. Purusha is an observer rather than an actor. So mental processes like thoughts and dreams are also part of Prakriti. I mean, they're things that are happening, that are changing. Let's talk about each of those parts of the dualism in a little more detail. Prakriti is primordial matter, and this is a single substance which is the source of the physical and the psychomental universes. That is, everything that we perceive both outside and inside ourselves, this is what accounts for the changing, developing, diverse world is made up of three dispositions, or gunas, they're called. Okay. We mentioned these when we talked about the Bhagavad Gita. These can be thought of as three modes of nature. They're sort of like yin and yang in Taoism. They're not objects, but they're qualities within objects. The three gunas are sattva, which is bright and intelligent, raja, which is active and passionate, and tamas, which is heavy and lethargic. Now, one or the other of those three may be dominant in some things or in some people. And basically, the effects of those three are pleasure, pain, and indifference. And then those get combined into different quantities in various things. Everything in nature is changing and transforming. The world is real, it's not an illusion, but it's in constant motion. And imbalance leads to interaction between things, particularly between Prakriti, remember matter, and Purusha in spirit. When Prakriti is in proximity to Purusha, it starts to become active. It may be something like children whose mother is on the telephone, right? She starts talking, and then suddenly the kids start bouncing up and down, trying to get her attention. It turns potentiality into actuality, and then eventually Prakriti might calm down in these interactions as well. Things come and go. This ongoing process of coming and together and then coming apart include our mental lives. So our ego is part of this process, our memories, our ideas, even our mind. Okay, so what's left? What's the other side of this half of the dualistic system? And the other side is Purusha, pure consciousness. It can't act on its own, but it only watches the cosmos unfold. It's the eternal observer of Prakriti that's sort of moving out there. Now, the problem is that Purusha might be entranced by what it sees. It might mistakenly identify with Prakriti and then become entangled in samsara, reincarnation, right, which leads to suffering. It may be a little bit like watching sports on TV. Right? You're watching your favorite team, and as they start to win, you get very excited, or maybe you get depressed when it looks like they're behind, and you get emotionally involved with something that's actually quite separate from you. Or maybe even a better example is it's like watching the Weather Channel. You may see a huge blizzard coming in, but even though you're quite comfortable living in California or Florida, you start to feel a little bit chilly. Maybe go put on a sweater. Ishvara Krishna has a marvelous analogy for all this. He says, it's like a blind person and a lame man who are trying to get somewhere together, right? So the blind person has to carry the lame man on his back, and the lame man is going to direct where he's going, and the blind person is going to be the bottom part of that piggyback. So Prakriti can't see anything, and Purusha can't do anything. Okay, back to this analogy, you can imagine the guy on the back saying, you know, be careful of that rock there, there's a step, or turn left, you're going to run into a tree. And it's, you just know somebody's going to get hurt in this. And this is where sort of suffering and samsara comes from this uneasy, unnatural combination of Prakriti and Purusha. So primordial matter, Prakriti, is unconscious both of itself and also of the difference between itself and spirit. It has no idea what's going on. Consciousness is in the realm of spirit. And according to Ishvara Krishna, there are innumerable spirits or selves, each of which, in its pure state, is silent, peaceful, and inactive. But they become deluded. I mean, they've forgotten their true nature, and now they're caught up in the world that they should be just observing. Liberation, moksha, comes from making a clear distinction between Purusha and Prakriti. When one of these innumerable spirits is able to differentiate what's self from what's not self, it can become isolated once again, and thereby freed from the bondage of primordial matter and its attendant suffering. So how does one attain this sort of discriminative knowledge, right? One that can see the difference between the two? And the answer is the other half of this pair of Indian philosophies, the school of yoga. So metaphysics is going to lead to ethics. This is the way the world is, so this is how we should act. And the second great mind in this lecture is Patanjali. His life is even more obscure than Ishvara Krishna. Scholars debate whether he lived in the 2nd century BC or the 3rd century AD, which is a big gap there. It depends on whether he's the same person named Patanjali who wrote an early study of Sanskrit grammar. Non-scholars tell stories about how Patanjali was the incarnation of the mythical serpent Ananta. I don't know about that, but we do have a text that's ascribed to Patanjali, the Yoga Sutra. It's a little bit like the Tao Te Ching in that we have a book, but the author is somewhat shadowy or even legendary. Yet the Yoga Sutra, unlike the rather eclectic Tao Te Ching, is a much more coherent, integrated work, and it presents the first systematic treatment of the enormously important topic of yoga. So just to make sure we're clear on this before we move on, Patanjali probably lived before Ishvara Krishna, but I spoke about the Samkhya philosopher first because without the concepts of primordial matter and spirit, yoga is not going to make a lot of sense. So Patanjali is responding to ideas that were already in existence, but were later put into their classical form by Ishvara. So Samkhya is the theory, and yoga is the practice, right? Okay. The term yoga comes from the Sanskrit word that means to join or to yoke. And it sounds like, yoke sounds like yoga, because these are Indo-European cognates. The languages have similar roots. It also refers to actions such as taming horses or yoking them to a chariot. Here the idea is to tame one's body and mind and yoke them to a spiritual discipline that will lead to liberation. When we think about yoga today, often the first thing that comes to mind are unusual, a little bit uncomfortable body postures and breathing exercises. This modern form of yoga, which has developed in the last 150 years or so, is related to the ancient practice, but the goals are different. Patanjali was not trying to help people reduce stress or lose weight or stay flexible or realize their potential. Instead, he was describing a method for escaping the suffering that comes when Purusha is entangled with Prakriti. But it's not something that you can think your way to. Remember that thoughts are part of the buzzing, churning world of Prakriti. The key idea in Patanjali's yoga is meditation. Okay, Let me make a quick clarification here. Meditation is not something mystical or exotic. Think of it more like learning to play a musical instrument. It's a skill that can be developed. It might feel awkward at first, but if you put in a concentrated effort and practice diligently, you're thinking of music here, right? Under the direction of an accomplished teacher, over the course of many years, you can train your body and your mind to do things that will amaze your friends when you sit down at the piano. When I was an adult, after I had already become a professor, I started taking cello lessons. I'd never played a stringed instrument before. I actually played the piano and could read music. But still, I found the cello very difficult. Learning to do vibrato is tricky, and intonation is hard. With a stringed instrument that doesn't have frets, you have to listen really carefully to get your finger in exactly the right position. It's not like the piano where you just hit a key and then whatever sound comes up is what you get. I will never learn to play like Yo-Yo Ma, but just attempting it, trying it out, gave me a much better appreciation for what he's accomplished. It also helped me to hear music in a different way. I now love string quartets, and I can listen to what they're doing, and I have a great appreciation. It's very difficult to even start and stop at the same time with three other people. Similarly, when I teach the history of Buddhism, I ask my students to meditate. Okay, I'm not an expert, I can't give them a lot of guidance here, but I think that unless you've actually tried to sit still and think of nothing, you have no idea how fast your mind is racing all the time. And that incessant internal chatter is not the real you, according to Patanjali. Okay, now let's turn to the Yoga Sutra. But first, we need an explanation of the term sutra, which is a particular sort of literary composition. We've seen the foundations of Indian thought in hymns, those are the Vedas, and in dialogues, as in the Upanishads, and the Bhagavad Gita between Krishna and Arjuna. But the disputes of the classic Indian philosophers were presented in a different type of writing, in sutras. These are collections of short, almost cryptic sayings or aphorisms, one right after another. The word sutra literally means the thread that holds things together. It's related to our word suture. Okay, now, that's Hindu philosophy. In Buddhism, a sutra is going to be a text that's ascribed to the Buddha himself, something he said while he was alive. Okay, now these sutras in Hinduism are different from the Analects in Confucianism, certainly different from later Confucian philosophical writings, which get sort of allowed for more extended arguments, and they're completely different from Western philosophy. Sutras may sound like just one list after another, but this form of writing allowed Indian thinkers to arrange their ideas into comprehensive, systematic, and rational order. They made the text easier to memorize, and then oftentimes the real interpretive work is done by later commentators or teachers when they're passing this on to their students. Patanjali's Yoga Sutra consists of 195 aphorisms, and then they're organized into four books, each is about a chapter length. And the four chapters, we'll call them, are on meditation, yogic practices, psychic powers, and liberation. These short sayings seem to be drawn from several different traditions, but together they form a general handbook of meditation. Okay, if you were to read just one book of Indian philosophy, it probably should be the Bhagavad Gita. But after that, I would recommend Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, particularly in Barbara Stoller Miller's translation. This was the last book she did before she died tragically of cancer at the age of 52. She was finishing it up from her hospital bed. So she has a clear translation and then some very concise explanations. The Yoga Sutra is short, and it's pretty engaging. Let me give you an example. I'll just start with the first section, which starts with four aphorisms. These are actually just going to be sayings, or in this case, they're just sentences. So here it is. Number one, this is the teaching of yoga. Next sentence. Yoga is the cessation of the turnings of thought. Three, when thought ceases, the spirit stands in its true identity as observer to the world. And fourth, otherwise, the observer identifies with the turnings of thought. Okay, only 94 to go. Okay, the key terms and ideas in that, remember, like being an observer, should be recognizable to you from our discussion of Samkhya philosophy. Patanjali goes on to enumerate the various turnings of thought. There are five of them that include valid judgment, error, conceptualization, sleep, and memory. And then he continues by listing the ways that one can stop these turnings, the obstacles that must be overcome and so forth, until Purusha can become disentangled from Prakriti, that includes these turnings of thought. Now, Patanjali's yoga includes eight stages, which are referred to as the eight limbs. Okay, it sounds a little like the Buddhist Eightfold Path. It's probably not a coincidence. People are talking and arguing with each other. Now, in the path of yoga, this can be a long journey, and it progresses from outer strengths to inner capacities. So the first two stages involve moral discipline, and then the next three are physical discipline, and then the last three are mental discipline. So moral discipline starts with, here's the first of eight, restraint. And this list is borrowed from Jainism, the basic morality. No violence, no lying, no stealing, no lust, no greed or attachment. Okay. Second stage of yoga, again from morality, are the observances. We had the thou shalt nots, and now the thou shalts. And there are going to be recommended positive habits of body and mind, things like purity, contentment, asceticism or austerity, study and devotion. Unlike Samkhya, which sees no need for God, the yoga school has a role for a divinity, a supreme Purusha that has never been intertwined with Prakriti. And then we move to the three stages of physical discipline, starting with posture. So you can keep your body healthy and under control with these, because your body affects your mind. Actually, your body and your mind are made of the same stuff. They're both Prakriti. Now, he doesn't give you specific postures, but he probably has in mind the lotus position. Remember that famous sort of cross-legged sitting position that's used in meditation. And then later, this was elaborated into Hatha Yoga, which is a whole system of hundreds of bodily postures. Okay, the fourth stage is breath control, deliberate inhalation and retention and exhalation of the breath, and often while counting. And then the fifth stage is withdrawing the senses. And they describe this as being like a turtle that sort of brings in its head and its limbs. This is complete control of the body, freed from desires and distractions. So you're going to isolate sense organs from their objects. So when you meditate, you don't exactly close your eyes. You sort of half close them, but you just don't pay attention to what's coming in through your eyeballs. And the mind is thought of as an internal sense organ that can reach out and grab onto ideas and concepts and memories. You want to keep that still as well. Okay, now we've moved from moral discipline to bodily discipline, and now we're into mental discipline for our last three stages. Number six is concentration, focusing one's attention on a single object, maybe on your navel, on the tip of your nose, or some internally visualized image, or being completely aware of the present moment. There's a steadiness and a calmness and stability. So you bring your wandering attention back to a focal point. When you try to meditate, just sort of counting your breath from 1 to 10 over and over, it's amazing how often you lose count because you get distracted by thoughts that are flitting in and out. Okay, the seventh stage, we're almost done, is meditation. It's jhana, which is the parent word in Sanskrit of the Chinese word chan, which is the parent word of the Japanese word zen, if you've heard of Zen Buddhism. This is unwavering attention on a particular object, and then objectless attentiveness. So the agitations of the mind stuff are quieted and pure consciousness can start to shine through. And then last is absorption. The spirit is absorbed or immersed in meditation, but may still be aware of objects outside of itself. And then the highest level of absorption, that the consciousness is no longer conscious of anything outside itself. It's not even self-conscious. It's described as being like a sleepless sleep. Through the discipline of yoga, then, thinking is stilled and consciousness is freed. And remember, when thought ceases, the spirit stands in its true identity as observer to the world. Remember that quote from the opening of the Yoga Sutra. According to Patanjali, as a byproduct of this long and arduous moral and physical and mental training, individuals can sometimes gain supernatural powers. Knowledge of the past and the present and the future, where they have the ability for their minds to enter into the bodies of others, where they can become large or small or heavy or light. This is the origin of the Indian practice of lying on a bed of nails without being hurt. Yogic masters might even learn to levitate. But those are all hindrances to progress. They're distractions. The true goal is to escape bondage to primordial matter. Okay. Now, let's think for a minute about practical applications. For its own practitioners, for believers, yoga offers liberation, freedom from the world of pain and suffering. Yoga is very influential in India. All of the six philosophical schools, actually including Buddhism and Jainism, they all adopt some form of yoga, some form of meditation. And it's interesting that the path of yoga that Patanjali teaches with its eight limbs has always been open to women. There are some famous female yogis. For outsiders who are interested in the practice of yoga, but they don't really care about the metaphysics of Samkhya, yoga can offer calmness and mental stability, heightened perceptions, and higher states of awareness and consciousness. The program of improvement starts with morality and then goes to the body and then to the mind, which is an interesting sequence. I mean, I can imagine one that starts with your thoughts and then that comes to your body and then you act them out, manifest them in your morality. For the philosophically inclined, it offers an astute analysis of mind, which is not quite like the mind-body dualism in Western philosophy, right? That Patanjali sees this keen awareness of a connection between the mental processes and the body. And indeed, the mind is part of the body. So the thinking self is not your real self. Do you remember that the Western philosopher Descartes once said, "I think, therefore I am"? That wouldn't quite work in Samkhya or yoga philosophy. And then there's a certain psychological acuity here as they examine the processes of thought and mental action. For example, memory is one of the five turnings of the mind. And it's not a simple recollection of past experiences. Rather, it's a complex process by which the mind perceives certain mental objects, which may be true or false, but which nevertheless have some reality because even false memories can cause behaviors and have other concrete effects. If you've ever struggled to recall something, you know how complicated and elusive memory can be. And the potential is even richer from an Indian perspective that includes reincarnation. Barbara Stoller Miller, in her introduction to the Yoga Sutra, cites a marvelous verse from Kalidasa's famous play, Shakuntala. Okay, Kalidasa lived somewhere around the 4th or the 5th century AD during the Gupta Empire, and he's oftentimes thought of as the Indian equivalent of Shakespeare. In this play, there's a king who goes on a hunting trip, and he meets a young woman who's been adopted by a sage living in a forest hermitage. They fall in love, he marries her, and then suddenly he's called back to the court. But he leaves her with a ring so that when she comes, follows him and comes to the palace, she can produce this ring and claim her place as queen. Unfortunately, she inadvertently offends a wandering holy man who puts a curse on her that her husband will completely forget her until he sees the ring again. Okay, she's traveling to the court, she's crossing a river, she's in a boat, she leans down to touch the water, and the ring falls off. She loses it. Okay, she still goes to court, and alas, when she sees her husband, he doesn't remember her at all. She goes away, brokenhearted, rejected, but then a fisherman finds the ring and brings it to court, gives it to the king. The king suddenly remembers his wife, he goes out in search of her, and the story goes on from there. This play was translated into English in 1789, one of the first works of Sanskrit to come into Europe. And the great German poet Goethe read it and exclaimed, "If you want heaven and earth contained in one name, I say Shakuntala and all is spoken." Okay, so back to the puzzle of memory. The king has been cursed to forget the woman that he loves, but when he overhears music, and what a powerful effect music can have on memory, he says, this is so good, I just want to quote this directly here. "Why did hearing the song's words fill me with such desire? I'm not parted from anyone I love. Seeing rare beauty, hearing lovely sounds, even a happy man becomes strangely uneasy. Perhaps he remembers, without knowing why, loves of another life buried deep in his being." How do we account for those vague yet overwhelming longings that we all experience from time to time? Now, there may be answers in science and psychology, but I sort of like this poetic, deep introspection that we see in this play. Memories of other lives buried deep in our being. What is the role of memory in forming our minds and our sense of self? I mean, they're crucial, right? Which is why Alzheimer's disease can be so terrifying. When a person loses his or her memories, does he or she also lose herself? But that might be the goal of Patanjali's yoga, by which we can stop the painful turnings of thought and memory. Okay, so we've got a lot to think about spirit and about primordial matter, about metaphysics and ethics, about the connection between memory and identity. I'll see you next time.